with our guest, Peter Lance. Peter, before we go to the network break, I want you to finish this incredible TWA 800 story, if you would. Go ahead.
We have how many minutes?
I've got a few minutes before the break.
All right. Very briefly, what I show in this in cover-up, my book, based on these FBI 302s and other investigation that I've done, is that basically the plane takes off the night before this incriminating evidence is going in. There's an event in the area of the center wing fuel tank that everyone agrees destroys the plane. The plane is decapitated, plunges to the Atlantic Ocean, 230 people, cast and crew, are dead. That night, a Situation Room meeting is convened at the White House. James Kallstrom, head of the New York office, puts 1,000 agents out on Long Island. Why? Because they've been seeing this evidence from Rams Youssef through Greg Scarpa Jr. for weeks, threatening the identical event to happen. What happens is, in the weeks that follow, they dredge 96% of this plane is dredged up by the good old U.S. Navy. The missile theory, I believe, was completely specious, in effect, the event that happened was a Al-Qaeda bomb was placed at Youssef's behest, contacting, using the patch through, the Roma Corps patch through, getting one of his guys to get, I believe the bomb may have been placed in Athens, Greece, which had porous security at the time. But in the weeks that followed, George, what do they find when they get the wreckage together in a hangar in Long Island? IDX, PETN, and nitroglycerin, those three high explosives, are found in the area between the 17th and 20th, the row, exactly where they would be if, in fact, a Bojinka device had been placed on the plane. James Kallstrom is a heartbeat away from calling this a crime. In fact, the New York Times on the 22nd of August runs a story, evidence of bomb found on plane. And Kallstrom goes to a meeting in Washington with Jamie Gorelick, Deputy Attorney General Louis Freeh, the FBI director, and whatever is said at that meeting comes back and does a 180-degree turn and starts saying, well, maybe there are other reasons you could have explosives on a plane other than a bomb. And the people are going, what is he talking about? And a month later, they come up with this absurd theory that a canine officer in St. Louis was doing a bomb-sniffing dog test on that aircraft 6 weeks earlier in St. Louis and somehow spilled the ingredients that he uses. Well, I talked to the guy, George. You've seen my book. I've got documents that prove that he did the test on a different plane. In fact, I actually have the TWA gate assignment that shows that the flight that became 800 left 35 minutes after he concluded the test, by all accounts, including the FBI's, fully catered, fully crewed for Hawaii. Yet another identical plane around the corner that he says now he did the test on left 90 minutes later. So the only explanation of the FBI for the presence of high explosives I have removed, and I've got motive, opportunity, and incredible circumstantial evidence. Now, you would think that the FBI would seize on this, and because if I'm right, it's the second biggest act of terrorism and mass murder in American history, right? Well, what do they decide to do to cover up the case? And they roll over and they buy this completely undocumented theory of the NTSB that there's a spark in the center wing fuel tank, not a shred of forensic evidence for that theory, and they basically close the case on November 17, 1997. Why? I contend they covered it up for this reason. R. Lindley DeVecchio, that supervisory special agent with the allegations of corruption, if that had been proven true, it would have been a scandal of epic proportions. Also, the FBI was vulnerable in that the patch-through may have inadvertently furthered the TWA 800 plot. But the main reason they covered it up, where there were 75 cases initially in the Colombo War that the Eastern District in Brooklyn had brought. They spent years, millions of dollars investigating these mob guys. 14 of those guys had walked when lawyers got wind of this unholy alliance between DeVecchio and Scarpa Sr. So now there were 60 cases that, in the words of a federal judge, would become unraveled. And I found what I consider a smoking gun document, which is on page 315 of cover-up. And here's what it says in a nutshell. James Kallstrom, head of the New York office, on the 10th of April of 96, this is April, May, June, July, okay, 3 months before TWA 800 went down, he basically sends a note to Louis Freeh, and he says, New York believes, based on the investigative results to date, and assuming that there is no new information, there's insufficient evidence to take prosecutive action against Special Supervisory Agent DeVecchio. The failure of the Justice Department to provide a prosecutive opinion or for the FBI to administratively resolve this continues to have a serious negative impact on the government's prosecutions of LCN, La Cosa Nostra figures in the Eastern District, and cast a cloud over the New York office. In other words, let's get this DeVecchio thing done. Just Sunday, George, the New York Daily News ran an article in which Kallstrom is basically declaring DeVecchio innocent. Now, you have to understand, the Brooklyn DA had read my book. My book was out for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. I met with the Brooklyn DA last September, the head of the Rackets Bureau and a chief investigator. They had read my book. They used it as a blueprint by their own admission, and then they went from there. They developed extraordinary witnesses, and they would not have brought charges for homicide, second-degree murder charges, against an incredibly well-known former supervisory special agent of the New York office of the FBI, the man they used to call Mr. Organized Crime. They would not have done this capriciously. And what will happen now, if the District Attorney Charles Joe Hines follows this through, what's going to happen is congressional investigators, including Kurt Weldon, who understands the connection of Dietrich Snell to Abel Danger. Dietrich Snell is in the middle of this story as well, because I have an FBI 302 on my website from March 7th of 1996. Who's in the room with Scarpa Jr. getting this intelligence? Patrick Fitzgerald, special prosecutor in the Wilson Leak case. Valerie Caproni, who is she now? She's a general counsel to the FBI, the head lawyer for the FBI. And Dietrich Snell, who is the prosecutor of Youssef, who should never have been in a meeting with a spy. There are rules against spies in the defense camp. He's prosecuting Youssef, and yet he's talking to this guy who's ratting Youssef out and weeks before trial. It absolutely violates a number of federal procedural laws. And also, who's in that room? Howard Ledbetter II, one of the original accusers of DeVecchio. They're all there getting this treasure trove of information from Scarpa Jr. When the FBI decides to cover up this case and bury the DeVecchio case, they let DeVecchio retire with a full pension. They close down the case, and even though he took the Fifth Amendment at one point, he answered, I don't recall, 44 times after a grant of immunity.
Jeez.
If you and I answered, I don't recall, once after a grant of immunity, we would be jailed for contempt. This guy, how many supervisory special agents of the FBI take the Fifth Amendment and then have that kind of behavior in the face of an immunity grant? So he retires to Florida. The case is buried. TW 800 is covered up. And then the feds come up with this one. Greg Scarpa Jr. made it all up. They actually try and convince a federal judge, and they do convince a federal judge in 1998 when Greg comes up for trial, that it was a hoax and a scam. Well, guess what? Listening to your show, the last time I was on, a federal inmate in prison, I'm not going to name him because I'm afraid there'll be repercussions. A relative of his contacted me, and he heard me use his name on one of your programs as the man who basically said that Greg made this all up. Well, you know what he told me? I talked to him in his lawyer's office in February. I recorded the conversation with his permission and his lawyers. He said absolutely not. Did he tell the feds it was a hoax and a scam, and that Greg Scarpa was dead on? So the one man that the feds have used to try and prove that Scarpa made this up is absolutely now denying it, and that's going to be in my new book. And that happened. That connection came from me being on your program.
All right, stay with us. Peter Lance, your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And Peter, right before calls again, was it not Scarpa Jr. who just recently was the one who talked about Terry Nichols hiding some kind of
explosives
in the basement or in the bottom of one of his houses?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's what happened: when the feds decided to cover this up, Greg Scarpa Jr., who was convicted of RICO violations, not a single murder, he was selling marijuana, and he may have done some bad things, but Sammy the Bull Gravano killed 19 people. He got 5 years. Greg Scarpa gets 40 years. Not just 40 years, but 40 years in the ADX Florence, the Supermax, which is the prison that has Terry Nichols, McVeigh was there, the Unabomber Kaczynski, Ramzi Youssef. I mean, it's the baddest of the bad federal jails, okay? So he ends up there, and they throw away the key, and they figure it's over. Greg Scarpa, being who he is, and actually, I believe, being a man who really cares about his country, he's on the tier with Terry Nichols at one point, and last February, Terry Nichols tells him that there is a cache of undiscovered explosives, kind sticks and other explosives, that were buried in a crawl space beneath his home in Harrington, Kansas. Now, the FBI searched this house in 1995 after the bombing and missed this material. And Terry Nichols reportedly told Scarpa, who told Angela Clemente, a forensic investigator, one of the best, is the one that basically has gotten all this treasure trove of information. Angela Clemente, and she was instrumental, by the way, in helping with the DA's investigation in New York, a single mother of three. Anyway, Angela Clemente finds this out. She tells Congressman Delahunt of Massachusetts, and the FBI sends a polygraph specialist out to test Greg from Washington. They do a perfunctory polygraph. They claim he's lying, which he's not. And then, sure enough, a couple of weeks later, after pressure is brought by another congressperson, the FBI goes in and searches the house, and they find George exactly where Greg, not you know, within 50 feet or 100 feet or 3 feet, precisely by the centimeter, exactly where he says they're going to be, and exactly in the kind of boxes they're in and everything, 100%. So Greg Scarpa Jr., in my opinion, has risked his life twice to expose intelligence on terrorism, two acts of terrorism, the TWA 800 and the Oklahoma City bombing, and he's languishing in this Supermax in Florence, Colorado. He should be protected, and he should be brought in front of a congressional committee to testify.
Amazing. To the phones we go. Let's go to East of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, sir. Thank you.
This is John Cullen from Lima, Ohio, and I had a question in regards to the Iranian nuclear program that's been discussed. My contention is that the Iranians want to be attacked, and that leads to my question, why doesn't the Iranians just simply buy the warheads or the nuclear bomb from, say, Russia or Pakistan? You know, they're oil rich. Russia is cash poor. Why go to all the public display if they just don't simply want to be attacked in order to have a reason to launch a war?
Who's to say they haven't already? But, Peter, what's your take on that?
You know, again, this is an area that's not my area of specialty. So my opinion is probably no more valuable than a guy you might meet at the corner tavern, okay? I can only speculate. I don't know. That's a very good question. I think they certainly would have the capability of buying, suitcase nukes, nuclear weapons that are already with fissionable material that could be set off. I don't know. I mean, again, I'd rather, if you don't mind, I appreciate your question, but I'd rather stick to the area that I know very well and not speculate.
Okay, very good. Fair enough. Let's move on to West of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, this is Mark calling from Santa Barbara.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing, George?
Good
to hear you.
Thank you.
First time caller for your show. I had a two-part question for Peter. Who was in charge of the Able Danger project, and who gave the order to destroy the evidence there?
Okay, well, the Able Danger project initially was run by the Army for the Special Operations Command. And at a certain point, when it's unknown who specifically gave this order, there was a major named Eric Kleinsmith who testified on September 21st before a Senate Judiciary Committee. He talked about the actual destruction, but there's some confusion or perhaps obfuscation as to who actually gave the order. But there's one thing that's very clear. They moved the operation to Garland, Texas, and through Raytheon. Raytheon has an operation in Garland, Texas. And one of the things Kleinsmith said at the hearing is, we destroyed everything we had not already given to SOCOM. I'm convinced that all that data still exists. And I think the Army would have been insane if they had made these connections to Al-Qaeda at that point to destroy the data. So I believe it's there. My opinion, though, as to why this administration has buried a scandal on Clinton's watch is I think it goes back again to the Ali Muhammad factor. There is so much, if you will, negligence that happened across four administrations, including the Reagan administration, but specifically Bush 41, Clinton, and Bush 43, with people like Ali Muhammad compromising places like Fort Bragg, that they don't want to take the 9/11 investigation, if you will, back to 1989. Mm-hmm. They want to keep it focused on the last couple of years, which is exactly what the 9/11 Commission did per Gorelick and Zelikow, and Democrats and Republicans on both sides only focused on a piece of the investigation. By the way, Angela Clemente gave everything I told tonight. Everything I said about TWA 800 was given to the 9/11 Commission. All of Greg Scarpa's material, they flushed that as well.
Ah, I see. You know who was in charge of this project?
Who was in charge of Able Danger?
Right.
Yeah, well, Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer was one of the principals. Navy Captain Scott Philpott was involved. There's a woman named Dr. Ellen Pricer, P-R-I-E-S-S-E-R, who's a very important witness. She's one of the real number-crunching analysts. Jacob L. Boson, the fellow that did the link chart that I have in both of my books, had written a booklet with her on Al-Qaeda. He was involved in graphically representing the project. There were several outside contractors. Orion Scientific was an outside contractor that the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center used. You know, there are many players involved. And as I said, I believe the Able Danger material still exists. But nobody wants to go back and connect those dots. And by the way, one other very important thing as to why should we care, right? Why does any of this matter? It matters because we remain at great risk. The FBI is the principal agency charged with thwarting domestic terrorism in this country. Yet the FBI still does not have an effective computer system. They spent $600 million on a project called Trilogy, which is supposed to have what they call a virtual case file system. George and I and my 13-year-old daughter, Allie, could use Google, and we could do a better job than the FBI has. And George, you're laughing, but last week there was a story that the New York office of the FBI, the Bin Laden Office of Origin, a number of agents did not have email. And when Director Mueller was in front of Congress this summer, they've scrapped the virtual case file, the $170 million. Now they're putting out bids for new one. Guess when FBI Director Mueller said the system would be up and running?
What, 2009. 2 years from now, something like that.
So the point is, my contention is, you know as well as I do, this is America. If Bill Gates or Steven Jobs got the job, the FBI could have state-of-the-art computers in a matter of months. Okay, and guess what? I don't think they want them, because what will happen is programmers will input the data in their files and they'll connect the dots, and it will vindicate investigative reporters like me who've been saying for years they've had all this knowledge in their files and they fail to act on it.
Next up, let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hello? Go ahead, please.
Hi, I am speaking, I'm Singh from Winnipeg.
From where?
Winnipeg, Canada.
Winnipeg, okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much, George. I am listening to your program more than 2 years.
Good for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I am sorry, maybe my English will be very poor.
Hey, at least you're trying. That's all that matters, huh?
Yeah. And George, I am from India. I work in Saudi Arabia 2 years and 2 years in Dubai. And what I found to live there and work with the Muslim community, and what I study in Indian over history with Muslim before British, and what I saw the present situation in the world around the Muslim. In India, the 900th century around Muslim came in the beginning as a businessman or looting, and they took the power. And while they took the power in India, there was only Buddha and Hindu. And while they took the power, they took the resources. They give the resources if you become Muslim. If little mistake, they have to only one option, either change the religion, either become the, we will be hated. And this way, they make all those corny planning or their constitution according to the Muslim law. Now in India, we have more Muslims than Pakistan. And Pakistan, they are all 98% Muslim. One day before 1,000 years, they were all Hindu. In Bangladesh, too.
Is there a question there, sir? Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. This is the demography factor, how we can face, how we can teach our new generation to the... Because the, if we see the statistics, around after 30 years, the Muslim population around the world, it is going to more than any other communities. So how we can teach our children or our churches to increase our population or our demographic factor?
Well, hold on with that answer when we come back. And of course, Peter Luntz is our guest. We'll be back with final questions. We'll have him check in with the Singh, who's calling from Winnipeg, to get that final question as well. Wanted to remind you that our book, Worker in the Light, the one that I wrote with William Burns, B-I-R-N-E-S, is available at Amazon.com for pre-orders. It doesn't hit the bookstores until September 19th. But you can order it at a discount on Amazon.com if you are so inclined. It's about the paranormal world. As a matter of fact, I start my first interview on Wednesday with Publishers Weekly over this thing. So they're more excited about it than I am, to tell you the truth. Worker in the Light, that's the name of the book. And we'll be back with Peter Luntz. Peter, let's go to you and let's see if we can get this question out of Singh out there in Winnipeg. Singh, you still with us?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now what was your question specifically for Peter, sir?
Yeah, my question was, this is question and also the information. Because in Western, in Middle East country, they don't give citizenship to non-Muslim. Whatever you live and work 50 years. And while those people come in Western country, they want equal rights. And this type of things, we have to raise the issue if we, those people, while come their government, what you give to the non-Muslim in their own countries. And second thing, the population increasing factor, this is, if you go to the statistics, I think within 30 years, Muslim population it will be the more in the world. And third thing, what I noticed, is the Pakistan is the key organization to make the terrorist and send to the around the world, and Saudi Arabia is the funding. So those countries are the biggest enemy. I don't think so Iran is the biggest, because Iran is Shia. Shia and Sunni have biggest trouble each other. So I don't think so they are the biggest trouble for other communities.
Okay. And I think what he's trying to do, Peter, too, for you and us, is basically just to kind of give us an overview
right.
of what's going on out there.
Yeah, he makes a compelling case, as a man who's lived in these countries, that this extraordinary growth of Islam worldwide, you know, and there's no answer to this question. I mean, you know, as I said, George...
I didn't hear the question.
Well, I think what he was saying, the first time I heard him say, what can be done, I think he said something like, what could be done about this growing population? Of course, nothing can be done. I mean, my first book was called 1,000 Years for Revenge, and it was based on a saying in Ramzi Youssef's home, province of Baluchistan, that if it takes me 10 centuries to kill my enemy, I will wait 1,000 years for revenge. And that references the Crusades. You know, in the 11th century, there was actually a war crime by King Richard the Lionhearted, where he beheaded a number of Islamic of Saladin's fighters who were captured in a castle. In one fell swoop, I think, I don't know, hundreds of men were killed instantly, and it's actually considered one of the great war crimes of history. And that was an atrocity committed by a Christian king. So the circle of hate, George, which, you know, it just goes around and around. You kill my brother, I'm going to get your nephew next, and then he's going to grow up, and his son's going to kill your father. You know, it's just, it never ends.
You can't get rid of him.
And I wanted to say a couple of quick things, though, about the work that I've been doing and how it's done, very quickly. And I wanted to say some positive things about the FBI, in that I've always been very praiseworthy of the street and the brick agent, the agents of first impression, Nancy Floyd, who I celebrated in my first book, Len Prednishenkis. There are a number of great agents, Joe O'Brien, who was one of the leading organized crime investigators in New York, who helped to bring down Paul Castellano with his partner Andy Currens. These were great agents, and they are conscientious, and they care about the Bureau, and they want the Bureau to do a good job. Management is chronically the problem in the FBI. There's a bifurcated system. Why is it that an individual like me, with no subpoena power and no resources beyond the Internet, and a phone card, a playing card, and Google, and tenacity, and investigators like Paul Thompson at cooperativeresearch.org, and John Berger, who's an incredible researcher working with me on my new book, who has a site called intelwire.com. How is it that we are able to put this stuff together And yet some of these investigative agencies apparently can't. Clearly we're out working ex post facto, and it's much easier to go back, obviously, after the fact and connect the dots than it is ahead of time. But still, we're just individuals. Noel Downey, George, by the way, the head of the Rackets Bureau in New York, who I met with in September, do you know that he made one of the four cases against DeVecchio by using Google?
He actually
found one of the guys that was tied into one of these homicides by searching for him, and he found him on Google.
That's crazy.
And so, you know what? To me, that's a positive message. And what that says is, while government becomes more concentrated and beyond the people, while government continues to lie to the people, we have these extraordinary resources like the internet. And if individuals care and that they're willing to study and learn and get educated, we can find the truth behind 9/11. And that's been my hallmark with these three books. And if people look at peterlance.com and if they respond to what I say, and they listen to everybody, the Alex Joneses of the world,
sure,
that's why I celebrate what you do on your program. And by the way, Bill Burns, he published my book on Survivor, the investigative book. I think the world of Bill Burns, and I know you're going to have a bestseller with him, because The Day After Roswell is one of the best, finest books on the subject ever written.
Yeah, he is good. Back to the calls we go. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with Peter Lance on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, George.
Hi.
Let me get to my question before I forget it, but I did have a couple of comments.
All right.
My question for Mr. Lance would be, do you think that there's a possibility that Al-Qaeda is simply acting as hired guns, that they are working on behalf of someone else?
That's the George Norrie theory,
and,
as you know, Peter.
Yeah.
And, George, to get to the couple of comments that I wanted to make, if I could, a couple of weeks ago, I thought that was probably one of the best weeks of radio that you had. You had a guest on that subscribed to the theory that the buildings were imploded rather than exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also, I guess it was last week, I think, you had a guest on who had written a book about the hunt for the third Oklahoma City bomber. And I thought that those were excellent shows. And I think you're on to something here. And I hate to get you sidetracked, because your show does explore such a wide variety of anomalies.
And that's the strength of the program. It's not predictable.
But I think that these are things that are worth pursuing.
Sure.
On a perhaps a more consistent basis. But again, my question for Mr. Lance, do you think that Al-Qaeda may be acting out of purely monetary motives rather than any sort of political or ideological agenda?
I think it's a great question. If you look at the origin of Al-Qaeda, it's very much tied up in Egyptian Islamic Jihad. The main power people around bin Laden are all and have been Egyptian. Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the surgeon, blind Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, Muhammad Atef, Ali Muhammad, these are Egyptians that sided with bin Laden when he took over the network, the worldwide network that was set up to raise money for the Mujahideen and morphed it into Al-Qaeda. So clearly there were political elements behind Al-Qaeda, and whether or not they're surrogates I don't believe they're for hire or their profit is their motive, but I do think they've affiliated with a series of governments that we're allied with, including Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. I mean, it's undeniable, the connections, especially with the Pakistani ISI. So, and also Qatar, if you go back to that story I told about Khalid Sheikh, I mean, Qatar, think about it, is the country where we base CENTCOM. The actual control center for the invasion of Iraq was based in Doha, Qatar, and yet the interior minister of the country, the same man today that is, you know, essentially in this position of power, was the guy who helped the mastermind of 9/11 escape. So the query, whether every single move that we do in Iraq is already telegraphed to these people, pro-Al-Qaeda. So, you know, the answer is, I don't know whether or not they're for profit, but even if they aren't, they have enough of a political motive to be doing what they're doing, and they're doing it quite effectively. Again, the invasion of Iraq got the people who were essentially hated Saddam together, Ba'ath Party members, Sunnis, and Ali Mohammed, by the way, brokered a meeting in the 90s between Osama bin Laden and the head of Iranian Hezbollah, a Shiite, and it was like the Capulets and the Montagues coming together, and they agreed to, there's some evidence that they agreed to collaborate on the Khobar Towers bombing in 1996. There's another piece of evidence from Greg Scarpa on that, completely ignored by Louis Free, who devoted a whole chapter to it in his book.
Okay, next up, East of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Is it possible the cell structure, as effective as it is, as a psychological terrorist tool, so can quite often set forth things that they can't control? And in them putting a plane into the Pentagon, they extinguished a healthy debate between the military and civilian portions of our government on whether to conduct the latest Iraq war and so forth. And it really is not in the interest of these irrational people that war, if you think of them as trying to accomplish something with respect to themselves, and in putting that plane into the Pentagon, it was the most stupid thing they could do.
Well, actually, I'm not trying to support what the demonstrous act of 9/11, but I think they sucker punched us brilliantly. What they did was they attacked us and they drew us into their world, their theater of operations, and they've now created a Vietnam-like situation that has bogged us down and incredible strain on the U.S. military and the reserves, of course, and the National Guard. To the point where when we have a natural disaster in our own country like Katrina, we're ill-prepared to cope with it. And we are now in a bogged-down, unending situation. I believe that civil war has already broken out in that country, and nobody wants to call it civil war. But it was brilliant strategy. I mean, Bin Laden has obviously read Sun Tzu, The Art of War. And he studied General Giap, and he studied the tactics used in Vietnam, where, you know, the great American military colossus was brought to its knees by, you know, guerrilla fighters. I'm not trying to minimize the North Vietnamese regulars, but the truth is Vietnam, by, you know, the use of the punji stick and other primitive elements, they brought down the U.S. government. Now, you have to ask yourself, when we withdrew from Saigon in April of...
I wouldn't say they brought down our government.
No, I didn't mean they brought down our government. They defeated a world superpower, okay? And they caused us to withdraw from the Indo-Chinese Peninsula. I misspoke if I said that. I didn't mean to say that, George. They didn't bring our government.
I'm always
down.
Watching you, Peter.
I'm glad, and you have to audit me. We all need an editor, George.
Yes, we do.
But anyway, the question is, who's watching you, right? your callers. Anyway,
the one at the top doesn't get edited, Peter.
Anyway, the thing is that you have to ask yourself, all the people that are saying now, if we withdraw from Iraq, it's going to permanently damage America. We're going to get a black eye in the rest of the world in terms of our credibility. Ask yourself, what was the strategic damage to America from our withdrawal from Vietnam? Think about it. At the time, before the fall of Saigon, in 1974, April, everybody was saying, if we pull out of Vietnam, we're going to be dire consequences. Mm-hmm. America's foreign policy will be compromised for a year. Nobody will ever take us seriously. Not a single iota did it affect American foreign policy whatsoever. And it took X number of years to normalize relations, and we there. If we withdraw from Iraq, what I believe, and I've said this on your program, George, the worst elements of the insurgencies will turn on each other. We are the uniting factor that's bringing these guys together right now. We get out of there, and there will be a civil war. It will take a certain amount of time, but basically, I believe it will have the effect of purging the worst elements of the insurgency. And at some point, the courageous people of Iraq who want a government, who want stability and peace, will ask the West to come back into that country to help them rebuild and to have an infrastructure once there's some kind of stability. It may take dividing the country up into three sections. It may actually come to that. But the point is, what I don't believe is going to be some permanent horrible damage to American foreign policy, just as there wasn't after Vietnam.
Oh, I agree with that, Peter. We've got time for maybe one more call. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
I want to ask Peter what he thinks about Gina Davis's overall theory about Iraq's involvement with the Oklahoma City bombing, and is that really the reason, not weapons of mass destruction, but the Oklahoma City bombing might be the real reason we have invaded and occupied Iraq?
See, I disagree with Janie Davis. I mean, I respect her investigation, but she has gone went into this big thing about Hussein al-Husseini, who she claimed was a member of Saddam's Republican Guard. She claimed he's John Doe number two. I had a private investigator, a friend of mine named Joe Murphy in Boston, thoroughly examine that guy. Absolutely not. And there's just this is this continued attempt by the neocons to try and justify the invasion of Iraq by trying to say that Iraq was behind the Oklahoma City bombing is just absurd. There is some evidence that Ramzi Youssef interacted with Terry Nichols in the Philippines, and there's greater evidence that Timothy McVeigh interacted with extremist military former special forces people and right-wing extremists in Elohim City. And clearly the ATF had an undercover agent there named Carol Howe, and there's evidence that McVeigh may have received some bomb-making capability from them. But as to the Iraqi connection to Oklahoma City, I believe it's absolutely specious.
However, there could have been a Middle Eastern connection somehow.
There could have been a Middle Eastern connection per Youssef. And I don't believe the theory, the Elohim City theory, is mutually exclusive with the fact that Youssef and Nichols interacted. Edwin Angeles, the former head of the Abu Sayyaf terror group over there, I've got a sworn affidavit with his thumbprint on it saying that he saw Youssef and a man he called the farmer, Terry Nichols, in Davos City several years earlier. If you read my first book, A Thousand Years of Revenge, there's a chapter called John Doe Number Two. Again, it's circumstantial evidence, but it's quite interesting. But there's more evidence in this Jesse Trinity case in Salt Lake City now that tends to push the scales more in favor of McVeigh having been educated by these extremists, including a guy named Strassmeier from Germany who had tremendous weapon of mass destruction knowledge, and it's possible that that's where McVeigh got the information. He didn't have the ability on his own. I interviewed Stephen Jones extensively, his lawyer, and clearly McVeigh and Nichols did not have the ability to build anything close to that kind of a device.
What's on your plate in the next few months, Peter?
Well, I'm hoping to work with this National Geographic, with Towers Production, on this two-hour documentary. I've got to get my book done. It's called Triple Cross, The Ali Muhammad Story. And anyone that has any information about Ali Muhammad, especially people living in Santa Clara, California, or Sacramento, or North Carolina near Fort Bragg, I'd appreciate it if they'd go to peterlance.com, L-A-N-C-E, and send me an email.
All right, Peter. Thanks again, my friend. Keep in touch.
You're the best, George. Thank you.
Peter Lance, peterlance.com. He does his homework. There's no doubt about that. We've got a series of great programs for you all week long on Coast to Coast, culminating, of course, with my Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. So for Nikki Imbernoni, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Rob Ismail, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.